Welcome to the Tech Policy Podcast. I'm Evan Schwartzdriver. On today's show, Internet Copyright and the Future of the Music Industry. Regular listeners of this program may have heard our first episode on copyright recently with Mike Masnick, the editor of Tech Dirt, where we discussed online copyright and some of the big debates that are going on. You know, what responsibility do platforms like YouTube and Google have to remove infringing content? But how can we do that in a way that doesn't stifle free speech or disrupt the internet economy? There are a lot of competing interests here, and I wanted to get a different perspective than the one I got last time. So joining me to discuss this important topic is Stephen Marks, Chief of Digital Business and General Counsel for the Recording Industry Association of America, that is better known as RIAA. Stephen, thanks so much for joining the show.
Thanks for having me.
So to start off, who are the members of RIAA?
The members of RIAA are hundreds of record labels, including the major recorded companies and the labels that they work with and distribute.
And before we get into all the various copyright disputes, what exactly is the state of the music industry today?
So the state of the industry is good in that we have seen last year, for the first time in a very long time, growth in the industry. So if we just kind of rewind a little bit for some context, the industry today is about half of what it was in terms of total revenues back in 1999. So you've had this steady decline for about 15 years, about 5 years or so ago, revenues flattened. And then just in the last 2 years, and especially in 2016, we saw some real growth in the industry. And that's been mainly from streaming, and in particular, paid subscriptions from streaming.
And what do you see as the reason for that decline? Is it as simple as just saying that the internet came along and that just hit your revenues, or is it something more?
I think it's a number of different things. I mean, clearly the internet was part of it, and the way that people consume music was different. So you had an album world going to a singles world. You also had a tremendous amount of piracy 15 years ago when Napster came along, and you know the Napster progeny like Grokster and Kazaa after that. And so you had a lot of things happening at one time that were, you know, very disruptive to the industry. And so you had this very kind of, you know, pretty rapid decline. I mean, you don't often see for an industry as mature as the recording industry to have that kind of decline over essentially a decade. Those reasons. Piracy was the biggest one, obviously, but the way people consume music, was part of it as well.
And you could argue that piracy was kind of the precursor to streaming in many ways. I mean, from a consumer perspective, they might feel bad for some of the artists they like that maybe, you know, 20 years ago they could have made more money, or that in 1999 things were much better for RIAA members. But consumers might also look back to a time when they had to stand in line at a CD store to purchase a $20 CD that maybe had 12 songs on it. You do that several times a year and you're already looking at a very expensive enterprise to consume music. You could, of course, listen to the radio, but that's still an option today. So at the same time, maybe that the recording industry has lost half its revenue, it seems like consumers have more options than they've ever had before, and the benefit to the consumer is so great. So why should consumers feel bad about this?
Oh, I think that consumers do have more choice today than they've ever had, and that's a good thing. I think the industry is embracing that. If you look, for example, at how the industry has evolved over that time without focusing specifically on the revenues, we are now nearly 80% digital. That's by far more than any other content industry out there.
So like newspapers or books. Yeah.
Newspapers, books, but also games. I mean,
right.
Even things that people think of as digital, we're well ahead of those. And that's because the industry has wanted to meet consumer demand. Streaming services have actually been around for a very long time. It's just more recently that they've become something that consumers have become aware of in a mass market way and have begun to adopt.
And to the extent that piracy is a problem and remains a problem, have we not seen a decline in privacy? I mean, there was piracy. There was an article recently that said in the Netherlands, which used to be a hotbed of piracy, that it's plummeted, and they attributed the decline to the availability of legal streaming alternatives. Now, you might be saying that streaming's been around for a while, but maybe not the right streaming or the right business models. And if you kind of look at the timeline, you had 1999, people still spending a lot of money, and albums still going triple, quadruple platinum, which is basically unheard of in today's world. But then you had this gap where, you know, things like Spotify weren't necessarily around Tidal, Apple Music. And yes, it was illegal, of course, but in a way, didn't Napster, Kazaa, LimeWire, these illegal platforms actually bridge that gap because the industry wasn't mature enough yet to figure out how to use the internet? I mean, it is in many ways a market response, a black market response to the problem. I mean, and now we're seeing more streaming alternatives and more legal alternatives. So is the market not solving this problem by itself in some ways?
Yeah, I think that the market is solving the problem in many ways. And I think the industry and its partners over the years have tried to meet consumer demands. I mean, you know, streaming is everything right now in terms of, you know, what consumers are adopting, conversations, you know, it's the centerpiece of the industry. But if you go back, you know, 10, 12 years, you obviously had iTunes coming into the market, and that there was great adoption of that, both in terms of buying digital singles and digital albums. There have been a number of different transitions that the industry has gone through in a very short period of time. You know, the first was from physical to digital. The next was kind of like from desktop to mobile.
Right.
And now you have the migration from ownership to access. And so I think in each instance, the industry and its partners have responded with services to be hopefully very compelling for consumers to gravitate toward and adopt.
And at the same time that we've seen these massive changes in the marketplace, there has been a very long and bitter policy debate about the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, specifically Section 512, which we talked about on the last show with Mike Masnick, where this is essentially intended to protect service providers like YouTube or like Google from financial liability when a third party, i.e. a user, violates the copyright protections of a given work. I mean, that could be posting a song that you downloaded on YouTube and you're not supposed to be doing that, or it could even be someone taking a phone video of their television while watching an NFL game. I mean, we've seen anyone who uses the internet has seen things pop up and then sometimes they disappear and maybe there's a little message that says copyright violation. But the purpose of this law that was passed in 1998 was to try to strike a balance. And in your view, did they strike a right balance? And is the DMCA still relevant, or does it need to be updated to adapt to the marketplace?
So I think the way I would answer that is you have to look both at what was intended at the time and what has happened with the law in terms of the way it's been interpreted by courts, the way service providers like YouTube and others that weren't around then are now operating under the safe harbor. And those are two very different things in our mind. If you, if you go back to 1998, the intent at the time was to create a balance where each side, content and, you know, these platforms, had a certain amount of responsibility to address, piracy or illegal use of the networks. Now, you have to keep in mind that back in 1998, the platforms or the companies that were around at that time were Prodigy, MCI, Bell South, Netscape, bulletin boards. I mean, these are the companies that were at the table, and that their businesses were the ones that were being addressed, you know, in terms of figuring out this right balance.
So now, the lens that Congress was using to write the legislation was very much a current lens, not necessarily forward-looking in your view?
Exactly. And so you had, you know, the one thing about those services, they were either traditional ISPs or very passive services, you know, a bulletin board, somebody like just putting a something up and there's no real interaction with the content, for example, by the bulletin board operator. And if you look at legislative history, there's, you know, a lot of legislative history talking about how this was about passive acts versus things that are more active.
Now, and is the distinction there essentially a passive act is like someone has a song and they just throw it up on some GeoCities website maybe, and there's not really a business model, there's not much user interaction. This predates the Web 2.0 revolution of things like Facebook, YouTube, where users are starting to generate the content, not the owner of the site, whereas a more active situation is what we currently see, where you have content creators, you have platforms, you have trade associations, and everyone's kind of active in a marketplace that is functioning in a very at a very high level, even if you don't like the way it's functioning, right?
Yeah, I think what's happened is that, you know, there are a few things. The provisions of the DMCA included both which kinds of service providers would be eligible for the safe harbors and you know, kind of figuring out and striking this balance. That was a pretty narrow group at the time, like the companies I was just listing. And that has become much broader, obviously, because you've got companies like YouTube that are operating under claiming protection under the safe harbor. So, you know, that's one thing that's happened. And then at the same time, when you look at the substantive provisions about how this balance was supposed to be struck, there were a number of things like red flag knowledge, representative lists. These were all things that were in there. So, for example, when a company that was, you know, one of these companies that wanted to operate or claim protection under the safe harbor, if they had red flag knowledge, meaning they had, you know, enough knowledge, maybe not actual knowledge, but different from actual knowledge, enough information to know that there was a lot of infringement going on, they were supposed to take certain actions. Well, what's happened is, just to use that one as an example, is that the courts have required that they have knowledge of something very specific, and literally the very specific infringement. So being aware of a lot of facts and circumstances and knowing, having enough knowledge where you know, hey, I know there's a lot of infringement out there, is not enough. You have to know that the specific infringement, the specific URL is there. Now, in our mind, that was not the intent when the statute was drawn up.
Now, regardless of whether that is the intent, and you make a compelling point, many people would say that the bill, however intentional or not, was forward-looking, because you passed this bill and we've seen the development of these platforms and we've seen a lot of speech happening on the internet. And we also see options like publishing on Amazon or publishing your work on a third-party platform, which might have been cheaper than going through one of the labels that your association represents in the past, which many have criticized as gatekeepers. So without DMCA, however problematic, do you think this ecosystem would have developed the way it did? And maybe there's good reason for requiring actual knowledge instead of just a general knowledge, because you want to make sure that whatever content you're removing from the internet, given free speech concerns, is actually infringing. And many on the platform side would argue that if you reduce that standard to essentially, like, you just have to know that piracy exists in the world and that requires you to go clean up your platform, that is a much lower standard, and that would bias the platform towards removing things that could be potentially infringing, even if they're not, and then you create a chilling effect on free speech. I mean, that's what they would say.
Yeah, I think we have to distinguish between platforms that have developed and are flourishing that are not relying on the safe harbors, or and those that are. I mean, remember, a lot of the services and a lot of the things that you just mentioned, they're not relying on the safe harbors to exist. Things like, you know, tools for artists to be able to get their content online without having a major or an indie label or, you know, any label at all. That's very different from what we're talking about in terms of the DMCA safe harbors. The DMCA safe harbors were specifically about a shared responsibility in dealing with infringement that exists on a platform. And the balance, there really is no balance there. And I would agree with you that, you know, just being aware of that their piracy exists generally is not enough. I don't think anybody would assert that that's it. But when you have knowledge of that there is infringement going on your platform, that was supposed to create an obligation to take some steps to address it. And that's what we don't see. And the effect of this has been to distort the marketplace. So if we just go back to streaming, which is really the most important development and revenue stream for the industry right now, and it's important to keep in mind that while streaming is doing very well and driving growth for the first time in the industry, other revenue streams are continuing to fall. So physical CDs are continuing to decline, digital albums and singles are continuing to decline. So it's a very kind of fragile recovery, so to speak, because it's very centered on just one revenue stream. And then when you look at that revenue stream, you've got services that are essentially competing with it that are operating under the safe harbors and paying very little or nothing for the content that is offering a very similar consumer experience.
So can you distinguish between those two entities? Do you have examples? I mean, one comes to mind. Spotify is a streaming service that you pay monthly, and based on the way the platform operates, it's not user-generated content necessarily, at least not the average user. It's more like a professional user who might talk to Spotify about putting their content on there. So that would be one competitor. And then on the other side, you have YouTube, which is user-generated content. I mean, is that the distinction you're making?
Yeah, exactly. Because they are both essentially providing an on-demand experience. If you want to go listen to a song, you can go to YouTube and hear it at any time because the song is always available based on the fact that YouTube has not taken enough steps, relying on the safe harbors, to remove that content if that is indeed something that the artist or the owner of the recording wants removed. And if you just look at the rates that are paid, for example, for that very similar experience, you have about a 7-to-1 ratio. For every 1,000 streams, for example, you get about 7,000 from on-demand subscription services like Apple Music or Spotify, and you get $1 compared to the $7 from YouTube.
Is part of that just the business model? I mean, I'm a subscriber to Spotify Premium, for example, and the reason I don't use YouTube to listen to music, unless, like you said, it's just, I want to show my friend this one song and it's like the easy way to get it, this one time. But it's kind of clunky. It's not really a great experience. I mean, you very rarely see people use YouTube to, do like a playlist at a bar or a playlist at a wedding or something. I mean, it's not, every song is also a video. And if you close out the app on your phone, you can't hear the audio anymore. I mean, maybe it's just not the best way to listen to music, but how much of a problem is YouTube for the music industry? Am I wrong about the way that consumers are using these services?
Yes and no. Are the other services easier to use in some respects? Yeah. And I hope, and the industry hopes, I think, that people realize and understand that. But at the same time, there are tools and apps and things you can use to create playlists off of YouTube content using just the audio, not the video. And so you get something that is very substitutional for a lot of people. And
so parties are making it more like a streaming service, even though it's not.
That's part of it. But, you have more than 100 million people, upwards of 150 million people using in the U.S. using YouTube. So there is a lot of usage, and those are people who are potential, subscribers or customers of the industry to pay more. I mean, what happens generally as a result of the safe harbors is that you don't have the kind of market negotiation that would otherwise occur. So, for example, if YouTube was not relying on the safe harbors and sat down to get a license, you would expect that all of the things that you just said would be part of that discussion. Look, we're not exactly the same thing. It's not like using Spotify. And the parties would come up with an appropriate market-based rate or agreement or solution, that put YouTube where it belonged kind of in the overall scheme of things in terms of the rates it's paying. The problem is that the industry does not, and individual companies obviously negotiate for these rates, they don't really have the opportunity to have that kind of conversation. Because the conversation instead goes something like, we're willing to pay X. Label might say, I think that's too low. It's much lower than what, others pay. It's just not what I would think is a market rate. And then YouTube or another service in that position is able to say, well, okay, if you don't want that, then just send us notices and we'll take down the content. Knowing full well that that's not really a practical solution, because at any given time, because of what we were just discussing about the way the DMCA works, at any given time, you're able to find a recording of that label that's up there. Because it's a game of whack-a-mole.
Yeah, getting at that problem, which is just essentially that you can send a notice for this, then it gets taken down, but then it pops up again. So that's been a problem on both sides. And you can argue that even requiring the platform to do more won't necessarily solve that problem. I mean, like you said, there was supposed to be this shared responsibility where content owners do some policing of the internet to see where their stuff ends up, and then maybe the platforms do some themselves. I mean, what could be changed from a policy perspective, in your view, to change the whack-a-mole problem? Because it seems fairly intractable at the moment.
Yeah, I think there's a policy solution, and then there's, a business solution. I mean, the policy solution obviously would be to kind of restore the balance that was supposed to exist at the time that the DMCA was passed, if you just look at the intent. And make changes to the DMCA to ensure that that balance is there. But let's not let these very sophisticated technology companies off the hook too quickly in terms of saying, oh, it's just really hard. I mean, Google is one of the most sophisticated technology companies in the world. It has the best and brightest engineers of any company, that's out there. All we're saying is that they could, if they wanted to, they could fix this problem. This is not rocket science. This is not, a lot of the other things that Google is tackling.
Are you talking about an algorithmic solution or a people solution? So Google has both, right? They have a lot more people than a small tech company, and you make a fair point. I'm going to get to the fact that small businesses don't have those kinds of resources in a minute, but they have people. So theoretically, they could put a team on this, maybe hire some people to do it, or they could try to write an algorithm. What they would say about one is that you're making us create this division that we wouldn't otherwise do. This is not going to provide the most value for our customers and our shareholders. We're being made to do this to avoid copyright problems. Fine, maybe that's a fair trade-off. On the other hand, they might say any type of algorithmic solution is going to risk taking down content that is just free speech that is not infringing. What do you say to that?
I wouldn't care. It's not really an algorithmic thing. I mean, this, if you think about it in its most simplistic terms, this is just a matching exercise. So you have recordings that exist and you want to keep them off of a platform, if that's the mutual goal that everybody agrees on. All you're doing is literally matching what is a fixed product. What the copyrighted sound recording is and what it sounds like and
the
way
the
files
is,
and everything else. And so you're literally just matching, what is uploaded to that. So this isn't guesswork. It's not, this is not something that impinges on free speech in that respect. I mean, there are parameters that can be set that I think everybody would agree on to ensure that that's not a problem. To the point about smaller companies, there are solutions like this that exist at reasonable cost that third parties have developed. But you also have to look at the flip side of the small party issue, because you have a lot of smaller content owners that are unable, that really do not have the resources to either send the notices in the first place, or once they send them, to send, a second, a third, a tenth, a hundredth. And the Future of Music Coalition and A2IM actually did a survey, a study that they made part of their filing in the proceeding at the Copyright Office to review the safe harbors. And they found that overwhelming percentages of smaller labels and artists or musicians that were policing for their own work either didn't have the resources to send notices at all, or, you know, they saw their content right back up there as soon as they sent their notice, and then they weren't able to do it. And, you know, there was testimony from some musicians who said, one put it, I think, you know, very well. She said, look, when I wake up in the morning, I have a choice. I can create music, or I can go and try and send a bunch of notices. I can't do both. It's just too hard to do both. And that, I think, really captured what you know, the essence of the problem is. And even for larger companies like our members, you're talking about, am I spending money, you know, doing this, or am I spending money investing in artists? And, you know, when you look at the billions of dollars that are invested by, you know, labels and others to find artists, you know, help them develop their sound, their product, and, you know, and market it, money is being taken away from that effort. And there was one study that was submitted in this same Copyright Office proceeding that estimated between $650 million and $1 billion was being lost annually.
On enforcement.
As a result of the market rates that were low and the didn't even take into account the enforcement that's being, you know, the money that's being spent on that.
So when we look at potential policy solutions, it's interesting that you bring up the problems of the DMCA, because on the other side of the coin, and there's obviously more than two sides, but just to keep things simple here, the so-called copy left, we're talking about previous guest Mike Masnick, Public Knowledge, a lot of the platforms, a lot of the people that are very wary of any type of reform that would give your association a leg up on them. But they look at the current system and they also have problems, right? So, I mean, there's actually agreement on both sides, it seems, that the current system is not ideal. Now, politically, and I think Masnick admitted this as much, the discussion around legislation seems to not be amenable to the left, because they see it as essentially the status quo is better than whatever we would get from some type of compromise, and their concerns will not be addressed. So they're wary of legislating. What do you see as any type of policy solution, an ideal safe harbor slash takedown system slash whatever, that could be supported by a bipartisan block of members of Congress? And of course, there'll be some on the fringes who oppose it. But where can we get to some type of bipartisan compromise here? Because there are people who want to try to solve this.
So I think it starts with all of those people sitting down and discussing what the respective problems are from their perspective. You can't really find consensus until you have discussions.
And has there just not been much negotiation or discussion in the past 20 years?
There has not. And the DMCA actually includes something for the industries to work out standard technical measures. So industries can come together and agree on something that would work. So for example, if you're just looking at the problem of, you know, kind of like this matching that I was talking about, you could have all of the different issues around that, you know, ensuring that free speech is not caught up in any kind of technology or the way it's employed, you know, some of the other issues that you raised, et cetera. Very difficult for us to get people on the other side to the table to talk about those kinds of measures. And, you know, that is because it may be a variety of reasons. It may be that, as you were just alluding to, people think, well, at the end of the day, they're just going to be better off with the current system, you know, if they're smaller parties. But certainly the larger companies that are making a lot of money off of music, and let's face it, you know, most platforms that start, music is a part of it. It's almost always one of the first things that's you know, added as, you know, when you're talking about content, you know, that's being made available, and that's because it's valuable. People love music; they want to hear it, they want to access it. So, you know, you've got some companies that are able to take advantage of the safe harbors, not just in terms of their day-to-day practice, you know, with respect to notices or how they ingest them, but in terms of dollars, and they're big dollars. And so that is, you know, probably a big disincentive for them to come to the table. But
yeah, and the DMCA definitely did not intend for websites to be able to make money off of infringing content. So to the extent that that is happening, that is not the intent of the law. So that might be a very legitimate area where people can work out a policy agreement, because just being on a site that has infringing content, there's a value there because you're getting ad revenue. And then anytime you click on something that is infringing, if you're watching an ad before it, even if it gets taken down in 2 days, there was some money made there. So that seems like a very legitimate complaint. Now, given that legislation is a heavy lift, right? And so we might be looking at many, many years before anything happens in that regard. The current system, we've seen adaptation, we've seen market forces, you know, increasing streaming, we've seen piracy come down, we've seen more artists go on tour and do more in-person live concerts, and that's a way of adapting, and people have made a lot of money doing that. I'm not sure if that was included in the numbers you were talking about earlier, but where do you see this industry going if nothing happens legislatively?
Well, I think that it will continue to do what it's been doing, which is try to work with partners, whether it's streaming partners like Spotify or Apple Music or others, to continue to develop and offer things that consumers find compelling. I mean, that is the best way to deal with, you know, potential piracy or infringement. By the way, I don't want to dwell on the piracy problem, but just one.
Everyone likes pirates. It's cool. It's great. Right. It makes great fodder.
One note, even in the streaming world, what has happened is, you know, the way people, you know, it's not so much about downloading and getting a file and hoarding files like it used to be.
Right. That was like the Napster, Kazaa, LimeWire. Yeah.
And cyber lockers and things like that.
Yeah.
Now what's happening is that there's a lot of, you know, stream ripping. So, you know, there's hijacking of the streams or picking off songs, you know, and putting so you can create your own playlist without, you know, subscribing, or even after subscribing and then stopping your subscription. So that actually has been growing pretty, you know, if you look at the line, it's a trend line up.
So that would be that would involve taking the content out of the platform where it has been paid for. So like you pay for Spotify, but somehow the music or the stream or whatever is being ripped out of that platform where it was paid for and being consumed somewhere else where it's not being paid for. That sounds very technically sophisticated.
No, this is more like individuals using very easy apps that the apps themselves allow the individuals to basically pluck songs out of a stream to create, you know, to have either as a file, but more likely, you know, to create their own playlist from. YouTube is a big issue with this too, because you've got a lot of apps, you know, given that you have very low, you know, technical barriers to get over to actually, you know, to access or do this kind of stuff.
Yeah, the open source nature of the Google system.
Exactly. It's easy. And so you have, and they rip the audio from the video. So it's not like, you know, people are using this because they want to watch the video. They're ripping the audio from the video and then, you know, using that. So that's an issue. But I think, you know, to get back to your last question, the industry will continue to work very hard with its technology company and content distribution partners to figure out, you know, as consumers, you know, if there are other things beyond streaming in 5 years, you know, to migrate to those. And I think the industry has demonstrated that it gets it and can do that now, and has done so already a few times just in a very short period of
time. And in comparison to newspapers, which are now have many similar complaints as the recording industry, it seems like in many ways the music industry adapted to the digital revolution a lot quicker than some other areas like books, etc. There's a lot of discussion in the industry about data. And it might be difficult to properly measure the industry if we don't have the right measures on tour revenues and the, you know, merchandise and streaming revenues and things like that, and who's getting paid for what. So how important is data, having accurate data, in any type of policy discussion or just in terms of making your businesses viable? And what are we talking about when we say we need a good data set?
So I think most of the discussions in the industry on data have focused on having authoritative data for who owns the content, you know, who owns the recording, and who owns the underlying musical composition. And in the composition world in particular, that's not always an easy thing because you have multiple owners who own different shares of the song. So, you know, just to give you a couple of examples of why that happens, you have a somebody in the studio. People, other writers or artists stop by the studio or invited in to help lay down tracks, and they get songwriting credit because they're adding something to the composition itself.
It's like a share in a company.
Exactly. Another thing that is becoming more routine is that writers will write a piece of something, pass it along to another writer as, you know, a file. They're not literally in the same room, but they're accomplishing the same thing. And at the end of the day, you may have 5 or 10 or more writers who've contributed to that composition that's then, becomes a part of the recording. And so what often happens is that at the time that the music is delivered by the artist and it's ready for release, the writers have not worked out all the owners are and what shares they get. Because the shares are not, you know, it's not like, oh, there are 5 writers and we each get 20%. It may be one gets 50%, one gets 20%, one gets 2%. There are all kinds of, the numbers are all over the place, and that's something that's just worked out as it should be between or among those songwriters. The problem is that when you're ready to release something, and when you, especially if you're a streaming company that's offering 40 million songs, and those songs are getting streamed, for example, and you've got money coming in and you're ready to pay it out, you may not know who to pay.
And whose responsibility is it to create that data set? I mean, that this sounds like a problem that the music industry has to figure out, because how is a platform like Spotify or YouTube, to keep bringing that up, going to know who to pay?
Right. I think that you are right, that it makes a lot of sense for the owners of the content to be able to say, hey, here's the ownership information.
Yeah, here's the percentages. And everyone gets this.
Right.
Go ahead.
And this is where you can find the authoritative list. Because what's happening is that companies that need to pay out are starting to develop their own databases. And what you have is this redundancy of databases, you know, across the industry. None of them are completely accurate. And it costs a lot of money for everybody to put together different databases.
Why can't we just work together, guys?
There are discussions now among labels and publishers and others to address this issue. But again, it's something that is something that needs to be done together, both in terms of figuring out how best to make that available, and also the funding of something like that. Because you know, at the end of the day, the licenses that are required, for example, for the compositions, you're not supposed to be able to use it until you know you've attained the license and you know who the owners are and things. So it's a very complicated problem, but it's one that the industry is very focused on trying to address, given the importance of having the right kind of data, and also in just eliminating, if you think about those redundancies that I mentioned, that's a lot of money that's being created. And so if I'm a digital music provider, for example, a subscription streaming service, if I don't have to develop that my own database to figure this out,
maybe you can pay the artists a little bit more.
Exactly. I can spend money to market my service. I can spend money, you know, let's say it's, $5 of every 100 that I on my P&L and the costs. I now have $5 more to market my product, develop the product, pay more to creators. I mean, it really is, beneficial to everybody.
Yeah, I think we've identified two areas of waste that maybe people on any side of the copyright debate could agree is a waste of money. One is artists or companies or whoever just having to spend all their time sending notices. I mean, that's just terrible. That's not exciting. It's not intellectual. It's not creative. It's just lawyerly, it's stupid. But it has to happen under the current system for a variety of reasons, good and bad. Then there's this other wastefulness of just having duplicative data and not using the right sets. Now, the internet giants have come under a lot of fire recently. You've got people like Jonathan Taplin calling them monopolists. You have people doing interviews with The Economist saying that no one's ever going to have an incentive to create anymore because they're just going to gobble up all the revenue and we're just going to see less music and less content. And even though we're in a golden age of television, this is only temporary. Are you optimistic given the marketplace? I mean, do you think that we're headed for a parade of horribles, or is the industry, the creative people in it, is it adaptive enough to just survive whatever? I mean, whatever happens, maybe the internet companies continue to grow and they continue to gain market share and market power and people continue to yell at them and call them monopolists, but nothing changes legislatively. I mean, given the situation, are you a optimist about the future of music or a pessimist or something in between?
Well, I'm an optimist. I mean, I think that there are just if you look at this little snapshot in the last 10 years, and you know, you started off by saying, well, you used to have the choice of listening to your local radio station or buying a CD, and you look at what is available now, you have this whole continuum of choices for consumers, you know, starting with the same listening to radio, but then listening to internet radio stations, listening to customized offerings.
Podcasts.
Podcasts, right? Exactly. So there are many subscription streaming choices you still can buy. You can buy a single. You can buy an album. There are a lot of things that you can do now that you weren't able to. And I think that I'm optimistic about that continuing to happen. At the same time, I do think, and getting back to 512, this is, I think for us, one of the ironies of the situation is that as a result of what's happened with the safe harbors, you have, getting back to, you know, the conversation we were having before about people coming to the table and talking. Well, when you don't have the incentive to come and figure out the problem, part of that is you're essentially an entrenched incumbent in the business world of music at that point. And
because the current system is fine, like from your perspective, bottom line, as a company, if you're YouTube, maybe you just look at it and you say, you know what, it's fine the way it is now.
And if you're a competitor, if you're a startup and you have a little bit of a different twist, how are you going to break in to this when you've got companies that continue to rely on these outdated laws in a way that stifles innovation instead of, because they're essentially the entrenched incumbents who want to continue with all the advantages that they get from this 20-year-old law. That's not a good thing for bringing all those new kinds of services and ways to listen to music and everything else to consumers.
Well, I don't have to tell listeners about how important music is and why it's important for culture and just everything else. And it's one of those few things in the world that truly is universal and it brings people together. So regardless of where you stand on this issue, it's a very important debate. I'm thanking you for listening to this show. I encourage you to go listen to the other one and see maybe where you fall on the spectrum. And maybe when Congress starts picking this up again, if ever, you'll have something to tell your congressman about how to maybe find a bipartisan solution to what seems like an intractable problem. But this has been a very valuable discussion. I'd like to thank Stephen Marks, Chief of Digital Business and General Counsel for the Recording Industry Association of America, or RIAA. Stephen, thanks for joining.
Thanks very much for having me.
Follow us on Twitter and Facebook. Let us know what you think of the show. Send us an email at mediatechfreedom.org. Find this podcast in the iTunes store. Please leave us a review because we'll help others find the show. Thanks for listening.
The Tech Policy Podcast is produced and distributed by Tech Freedom, a nonpartisan, nonprofit think tank in Washington, D.C. To learn more about our work, make a tax-deductible donation, or find other episodes, find us online at techfreedom.org.